From the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Please Explain Daily. I'm Tori Maguire and it is Tuesday, June 2. We've woken this morning to more extraordinary scenes of protest and violence out of the United States. I am joined now by culture editor-at-large Michael Idato from his home in Los Angeles. Welcome to Please Explain Daily, Michael.
No, great to be here.
So you live in California. Whereabouts?
I do. I live in Los Angeles in Hollywood. If the microphone's particularly sensitive, you can hear sirens right now. So basically at the bottom of what they call the Hollywood Hills, next to kind of everyone's favorite hiking spot, which is called Runyon Canyon. So near Hollywood, West Hollywood, sort of in the once fun heart of the city.
So how fun is it right now?
It's a bit surreal. California was one of the first American states to lock down for the coronavirus. So we've kind of just taken a gasp of air off the back of a 70-day reasonably strict lockdown. There were lots of odd differences between the Australian and the American, particularly the Californian lockdown. And by that, I mean our conditions seemed to be much stricter, but we didn't have police. They were very gently handled. There weren't, as there were in Australia, cases of the police fining people on the spot. So there was an element of freedom to move. But we were under lockdown essentially for 70 days. Businesses were closed. The whole city was well and truly, like retail was closed. It was well and truly shut down.
Were people afraid, Michael?
During the lockdown, oddly, no. There's a really weird distinction in America versus Australia. By that, I mean, in America, even though President Trump and the federal government kind of dominate the media narrative internationally, American life is very state and county driven. The mayor and the governor, for example, have much more power over my daily life than the president ever could or does. So mercifully for us, we have a really, really strong LA mayor called Eric Garcetti, and we have a really, really strong and popular California governor called Gavin Newsom, and they kind of took coronavirus on the front foot. They did their own $1 billion PPE deal to get emergency equipment to essential workers. They did a whole bunch of things that sort of gave us an edge, really. And I think during that lockdown, everyone was incredibly calm. It was sort of an odd thing. Everyone was talking, everyone Zooms, everyone's texting, everyone's talking about supermarket delivery slots, and everyone's posting messages asking for people who have a sourdough starter that they can take. And then, of course, you come out of that, and what's replaced it is a curfew imposed by the state, enforced by the National Guard. So I'm now in a slightly transformed space where the streets are now patrolled by the National Guard, which are essentially army reservists who are called up at times of emergency. They're driving armored trucks. They carry automatic weapons. There is a curfew in place on the city, which went into place at 5 p.m. So if I was, for example, now to walk outside and I didn't have a reason to be going where I was going, I'm subject to arrest. I think people are now scared. I think there is the unease that kind of carried us through COVID-19 has given way to something more tangible, which is, I think, a proper fear.
Is the fear, Michael, of protesters, looters, that kind of violence, or is the fear of the authorities, the National Guard, the police, the army?
I think it's a combination of the two, because I actually think there's a really tremendous amount of sympathy with the protesters. I think, you know, and it's kind of funny watching it all kind of unfold on television, where your kind of perspective is the helicopter camera's perspective. I think there's a lot of support for the protest. I think a lot of people are really tired in this country of kind of a very heavy-handed policing. And there is a sort of history here that doesn't exist in a lot of other Western democracies, where American military surplus, as it transitions out of its operational lifetime, it's often onsold into police jurisdictions. You have a lot of parts of America where the police, they are wearing body armor, they travel in armored vehicles, they have automatic weaponry. There is a kind of a level of physical policing in this country that's a bit different to how, I guess, as an Australian, I'm used to it, or even as a person who travels. And the funny thing is that you go to a country like Spain where the police do carry automatic weapons routinely, but they still somehow seem to blend into the street a little more smoothly than their American counterpart does. And I think watching television pictures right now, you know, I mean, today alone, I saw one reporter has lost an eye to a plastic bullet. There are children being maced. There are police vehicles driving into protesters. It's really hard to sort of reconcile the common logic, which is the law and order side are the goodies and the crazy people, the noisy people are the baddies. It's hard to reconcile that when the television pictures seem to frequently contradict it, you know. And we live in the mobile phone era where I've seen every day on my Facebook feed there's another clip of a black American or a minority American getting a raw deal from law enforcement. So it's really hard not to understand that that's a problem.
How connected or disconnected do people in LA feel to the rest of the country? Because this recent round of violence was kicked off by a terrible act of police brutality. LA sort of pioneered police brutality, kicking off riots with Rodney King all those years ago. The LA police, what's their reputation like compared to other police forces in the United States?
Actually quite good, I think, broadly speaking. I mean, the Rodney King case, which was the early 90s, at the time, the police had a terrible reputation. And in fact, in the aftermath of that case, Daryl Gates, who was then the police chief, was forced to resign because he had kind of presided over that very, very toxic culture. I think if you ask Californians or Los Angelinos, they would tell you that in the sort of intervening 20 years, we've sort of leapfrogged the national kind of perception on that from a place where I think LA was one of the worst police jurisdictions in America. Los Angelinos probably think that they've kind of leapfrogged to the kind of the front of progressive policing. That said, you know, I mean, I'm looking at a lot of news pictures here of LAPD officers not helping and provoking the protest. And in other places, some of the extraordinary images you've seen in the last 48 hours are, you know, the police officer in Flint, Michigan, who asked his officers to lay down their batons, and they walked with the protesters and it was peaceful. Or, you know, the police officer in Louisville, Kentucky, who, confronted by a protester who had burst into tears, hugged him and they hugged it out. And it's a ridiculously small moment in an incredibly complex situation, but they give you sort of indicators that there are sort of some positives to be found there. I think generally speaking, we feel safe with the LAPD. I think right now what's frightening is that everyone's in a situation where fuses are incredibly short and there is no time for nuanced reaction. So you're seeing a lot of overreaction and a lot of kind of unpredictable action because all these people are in situations where they don't have the 30 seconds that it takes to make a considered choice. They have 3 seconds to make the only choice that in their panic they think is the right or the appropriate one.
How much of this do you put down to people having gone through the coronavirus lockdown? I mean, it's a very strange set of circumstances, isn't it? Did this sort of simmer and boil and now it's just exploded out?
Maybe. I think the coronavirus lockdown is probably part of the equation, but only the very last part of the equation, because I think what's really roaring here is a combination of things, which is, I think America has, I mean, Australia has an imperfect record. America has 300 years of racial pain that is kind of seems to my eye to pivot on the question of visibility or being heard. I think at the heart of a lot of what's going on here is not that there's 300 years of racial pain in play, but it's 300 years of racial pain that's very frequently ignored, that there's been a history of peaceful protest that's generally mocked. So Colin Kaepernick, the footballer, took a knee and everybody mocked him for that. And now what I'm hearing on every TV news channel are all of these commentators saying, well, why can't we protest peacefully? And the answer is, of course, people try to protest peacefully all the time and they get mocked for it. And even if you look at those isolated police moments, Flint, Michigan and Louisville, the man crying, hugging the policeman, the police officer telling his men to lay down their batons, what drives those moments is actually the act of being heard. Those police officers took the moment to ask the protesters what they wanted to say or what they needed. There was an expression of thought. And I think the question of being heard is really the problem. I think there's a cumulative effect of just seeing everyday kind of racism in policing, but also there's this kind of second current happening in America, which is the phenomenon of the so-called Karen, which is the busybody white lady questioning why black people are doing really ordinary things like are in a park or having a meal or in a swimming pool. That kind of also has a cumulative effect where I feel like if you throw onto that the ignition agent of a US president who, the best way to put it is, describes white nationalists as, quote, good people on both sides, but describes black protesters as, quote, terrorists, the question of race in this country has just been poisonously kind of exposed as really, really toxic. On top of that, you put everybody in lockdown for 70 days. I think you kind of, America's weathering this kind of perfect storm of all of these conditions that have basically set themselves up for an explosive outcome.
Michael, just finally, how are just ordinary business people in Los Angeles coping? I mean, restaurateurs and corner store owners, they would have thought they were coming out of lockdown and now they've got a curfew. What are they going through?
Well, I think a world of pain. In California, retail was closed. So I know in Australia, you had shopping malls open and things like that. In LA, we didn't. The malls were closed, stores were closed, restaurants were allowed to stay open for takeaway only. So the actual lockdown was incredibly confining. It was actually very much a lockdown and not a sort of social distance kind of thing. What's fascinating about the curfew is, unlike the lockdown, the curfew means they're not even open for takeaway. I mean, well and truly, if you don't have food in your refrigerator the day the curfew was first imposed, you really had no option. The curfew was strict. So I feel like these businesses, having taken an absolute hiding for 2 months, take their first gasp at the idea that they might be able to either open as a store or open as a restaurant to a small number of people. And the curfew is something else again, essentially. I mean, it sort of seems glib to call it a police state, but the city of Los Angeles now, like a lot of cities in America, under curfew, essentially there are soldiers patrolling the streets and you have no cause to be outdoors unless you're either going to or from your place of work or you're an emergency worker. So I think they're taking another financial hiding. And I think that the cities collectively are kind of, they're sort of locked up in this odd bottle of fear.
Michael, thanks so much for all of that. I hope you have some food in your refrigerator and that you're staying safe.
Safely indoors. There was a protest that's just passed me, in effect, about 3 blocks away. That is kind of a very peaceful protest, thankfully, that's marching through town.
Well, stay safe and thanks for joining me on Please Explain Daily.
Pleasure.
Today's episode of Please Explain Daily was produced by Yuji Shimada and Amelia Maguire. The journalists, editors, photographers, producers and tech teams at The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald work tirelessly to cover the news that matters. For coverage you can trust, visit our websites or buy our papers. To support our journalism, you can subscribe via our homepages or just search Subscribe, the Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.